Vermont. Senator Sanders, thank you for making time to come away. I understand you are headed toward another vote at some point. Where do we stand on this bill? And tell me a little bit about your objection to it. You are going to vote in favor of the passage of this act, but you did speak against something about it and propose an amendment.
Well, Ali, look, this country faces enormous crises in terms of health care, the high cost of prescription drugs, child care, higher education, climate, income and wealth inequality. This is what we call a reconciliation bill. And what that means is that we only need 50 votes. You don't have to get 60 votes. You don't need any Republican votes to do something significant for working families in this country. And unfortunately, for, you know, fairly well-known reasons, we have two conservative Democrats. We couldn't get the 50 votes that we need, really, to impact the needs of working families. So I have offered a series of amendments to strengthen the bill, which have not succeeded. Bottom line is that you have a bill which does some good things. We put some $300 billion into clean energy. And at a time when we face an existential threat in terms of climate change, this is a step forward. But on the other hand, as part of the deal, we're allowing oil and gas companies the opportunity to drill on millions of acres of public water and land. We're giving more tax breaks and corporate welfare to the oil industry. There is a reason why BP and Shell, two of the largest oil companies in this country, are supporting the bill. In terms of prescription drugs, this legislation takes a very baby step forward. We pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. In some cases, you well know, we've talked about it, 10 times more than Canadians. What this bill does is say that yep. Medicare should negotiate prescription drug prices, but only after 4 years, and they start off with only 10 drugs and go from there. So it's a very modest step forward. Bottom line is I'm going to support the bill because given the crisis of climate change, the environmental community says this is a step forward. It doesn't go anywhere near as far as it should. It is a step forward.
Yes, folks, Bernie Sanders there. We're getting back to Bernie with Ben Spielberg. Talk about how modest of a step forward that is. But yeah, here to fixate episode 79 on the missing half loaf. You know, yes. We're going to talk a little bit about what's in the loaf, but at a certain point, you're going to be like, where's the rest of this loaf going? Why do we keep getting a half a loaf all the time, if that? So we'll be talking with Ben Spielberg. Ben is a co-founder of 34 Justice, returning for a second time on Left Reckoning. But we'll get more on that later. Hello, David. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm good. I always love hearing an echoing Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, exactly. Just off the walls of, you know. Yeah.
No, I'm doing good. I'm excited to have Ben on the show. We got a lot of fun stuff coming for everybody tonight. I think we're going to be doing a think tank later this week for folks as well. Yeah, man, just been feeling pretty damn good. And I'm excited about one thing right now. I gotta say, my mind's still. Sort of
I was gonna say,
it.
Like, I can tell David wants to talk about what he's wearing right now.
It's out, y'all. We have our Left Reckoning merch store is up and running. Hopefully, it's humming along as we're live here. But y'all can get access to our T-shirt, tank top, and our hats all over there at leftreckoning.com/store. So hopefully we'll be able to see a couple of those out in the wild. And as you get them in, let us know, you know, tag us on social media and stuff like that. We'd love to, I don't know, Reckoner Nation, that's too goofy. We'd love to see our Left Reckoners out in the wild.
Yeah. So I
you're telling me who designed that shirt too.
Yeah, this is my buddy, Grant Ertl of, the band Quarterback Club alongside Chris Bruin, who does our guitar intros and outros. But he is also the designer of the Left Reckoning logos. And this was actually a sort of like idea we had for a logo back in the day of the Flaming Tex at the Texas State
Big
Fair.
Big Tex. Yeah.
And I actually wore this today, but it got extremely sweaty and I peeled it off myself and didn't really want to put it back
it's
on.
It's a little cleaner today, man.
But yeah.
Yeah, so be sure to check that out. And again, we appreciate everybody, especially our patrons who have been supporting us. We also had I've been working really hard on it, so I was happy to finally get it out. A video essay called What Was Left, Populism. We put out the first half of it, which is about how we got here, really relying and borrowing heavily from Leo Panitch, who's one of my personal heroes. So I hope you all do check that out and let us know what you're thinking. And hopefully we can get part two up pretty soon.
Yeah, I commend you, David. When David told me the sort of title of what he was working on, I'm like, that's a...
it was a little insane. I mean, once I committed, I sort of had to finish it, but I realized about halfway through, it's like, this is a huge subject for me to tackle. And then do my own video editing too, which I'm sure people have probably noticed. Luckily, I caught it before I uploaded it, just a little behind the scenes. I had accidentally uploaded, it was like ready to go, a version of it that had all of these outtakes and retakes, which would have been pretty embarrassing if that got off.
Yeah, that stuff's tough. It's a skill.
But anyways, folks, we got a lot to get to today, so I think we should jump in so we're ready for Ben when he gets here. I wanted to talk about something that we've been talking about since the beginning of Left Reckoning, which is this strike in Alabama, where nearly 1,100 coal workers there have been on strike at the Warrior Met facility. And just the briefest of briefest outlines for people who might be coming to us for the first time, hearing this for the first time. Effectively, what happened there was you had a coal mine that produces coal to be used in the manufacturing of steel. During the financial crisis, the coal mine got hit pretty hard financially. And the workers there decided that, you know, democratically, that they would accept a short-term pay cut to help make sure that the mine didn't close and have everybody lose their jobs. Well, now, fast forward a few years later, the mine is no longer owned by the same people. It's owned predominantly by, like, New York and international capital, BlackRock being amongst them. And the mine is making more money than it ever has before. And when the workers came up and they said, hey, you know, we made this deal with y'all, y'all need to pay us. The mine basically said no. So the workers there decided that they would go on strike. And now it's been a strike that's been going on for over a year. If you want more in-depth kind of breakdowns of what's been happening over this past year, you can go and search our channel for Warrior Met Coal. We've been doing a lot of videos on it. And I always suggest people check out the Value Labor Report, who we'll be hearing from in just a second. But I wanted to get to this update. And I don't know if you have the presentation handy, Matt. This is a news story came out from the AP. Earlier last week. And I'm going to admit to y'all one thing. When I saw this headline the first time, it took me about 10 minutes to realize what was actually said, because it just didn't even seem logically possible to me, the idea that that the NLRB could be putting out a statement saying that the coal miners need to pay $13.3 million to Warrior Met Coal.
Exact same reaction. Like, I saw that, I scrolled like you scroll back toward it and like, wait a second.
Yeah, for a second. And I realized that it was the complete opposite. But let me read this this headline to y'all. Striking Alabama coal miners refused to pay $13.3 million in order damages. And actually, this is from AL.com. The United Mine Workers of America today blasted what it called an outrageous assessment of damages, totaling $13.3 million tied to its ongoing strike against Warrior Met Coal, which is now in its 16th month. UMWA President Cecil Roberts said the union has no intention of paying the settlement amount. And then says, quote, the right to strike in America must be preserved, he said. We will fight this at every level, in every court. We will spend every penny of our resources rather than give in to something like this from the NLRB, Warrior Met, or any other entity. And there's some nuance here about what came out from the NLRB. But effectively, this is the NLRB broadcasting the settlement amount out to the public, where Warrior Met has estimated that their damages are somewhere in the neighborhood of $13.3 million. If we could get to that second slide here, I wanted to read the second bit of the this is a statement from the UMWA. In a July 22 letter, the NLRB sent a detailed list of damages totaling more than $13.3 million, which the union says is more than 33 times the estimated amount NLRB lawyers had initially indicated would be assessed. And the point, I think this has to be really clear here, that there's still a lot of questions as to what this even means. But of course, Warrior Met wanted this to come out to sort of get this victory headline especially in light of the fact that they just had their most recent quarterly earnings report come out, and it showed that they are, again, making money using scab labor at the facility. So this was another attempt for them to look to their shareholders, not to the community, not to people in Alabama, and say, look at what we're doing by promoting scab labor and this really brutal crackdown on workers. More than $12.8 million of the amount, according to the letter, are costs to the company, such as increased security, increased labor, barriers, security cameras, and lost revenues for unmined coal. Other items include vehicle damage. And again, if you haven't been following this story, it's very important to remember that the scabs have been hitting striking workers on the picket line with pickup trucks. So there's something really, really nasty about talking about damage to a vehicle here in this context. And Roberts, the president of the UMWA, says, called the amount a slap in the face, not just to workers who are fighting for better jobs at where met coal, but to every worker who stands up to their boss anywhere in America. These are charges for security, cameras, capital expenditure, buses for transporting scabs across picket lines, and the cost of lost production. What is the purpose of a strike if not to impact the operations of the employer, including production? Is it now the policy of the federal government that unions be required to pay a company's losses as a consequence of their members exercising their rights as working people? This is outrageous and effectively negates workers' right to strike, and it cannot stand. I mean, it's unbelievable, and this is another statement that came out too, which I just sort of read, but basically, the argument here is like, what's the point of a strike if the NLRB is going to basically come down and side with the bosses and saying you are actually responsible for paying the lost revenue that the bosses have lost during this period of time? I mean, this is a direct affront to the right to collective action, to the right to bargaining. And as we're going to talk about a little bit later when we go and talk a little bit about the United Kingdom, this is an acceleration of this kind of anti-union policy that we're seeing from our national federal governments here. And again, the NLRB could move on this. There's a lot of talk basically that this was them basically saying this is the amount that has been decided and we have not ruled one way or the other on it. But just this number alone is absolutely ridiculous and is an assault in itself to working people. There's a little more here too. This is from Kim Kelly, who has been unbelievable, not only in covering this strike, but in supporting the workers there. She says, it seems absolutely bonkers to me that the venture capital-backed Alabama Coal Company is legitimately trying to force the unions to pay millions of dollars for lost revenue for unmined coal. The union initially agreed to a settlement with Warrior Met in June in order to save striking members' families from days of hostile questioning by company lawyers. The NLRB's lawyers estimated the damages assessment then was $400,000. This is 33 times that. And again, just to be really clear, because whether or not what the final decision from the NLRB right now is sort of an open question. But what the kind of tactic strategy here was from UMWA was that for Warrior Met to sort of ascertain, for the NLRB to sort of ascertain this information, they were going to be sending lawyers and people down to people's homes and asking them all these kind of questions. And they decided, well, $400,000, we can deal with that. In procedure and push back against that because they shouldn't be paying a penny. The company should be back paying them all of their wages for the past year. So they decided to go with that. And in that moment, the NLRB basically allowed this company to put forward this absolutely egregious number here. And let's just really briefly, just to sort of break down some of this stuff, jump over to our friends at the Valley Labor Report, who you guys should all be listening to and supporting if you aren't already. I'm talking about this. Jacob here first notes the fact that UMWA luckily is not alone. In fact, other unions have come out in support, including the Teamsters. So here we are here.
The Teamsters came out with a statement yesterday as well. Quote, the Teamsters proudly stand with our brothers and sisters of the United Mine Workers of America to combat this assault on American workers by the National Labor Relations Board, said Teamsters General President Sean M. O'Brien. Are we simply going to strip hardworking Americans of their ability to organize and of their freedom to strike corrupt employers? At what point is the federal government going to intervene to actually protect working people?
Right.
We're going to keep you updated on the proceedings here, obviously. The next step is that the NLRB will take the union's response to this basically opening volley from Warrior Met, and then Region 10 will complete their own assessment of the costs. And then, if an agreement is not reached, they'll go before an administrative law judge, and their opinion could be appealed before the general counsel of the NLRB, and then they could appeal that to district court, a federal court of appeals or something. The NLRB press secretary yesterday told me that if there's not an agreement with the region's ultimate decisions, which will come after the union responds, the region will commence a proceeding before an administrative law judge where the parties can present arguments and evidence about what each considers to be appropriate damages. So, you know, we'll see what Region 10 comes out with. My understanding is that the UMWA what they've been responding to in the last week is not actually a ruling or a decision or anything from the NLRB, but more like letting them know what Warrior Met's saying that their bill is and asking for a response. So we'll see if Region 10's assessment is even remotely close to what Warrior Met is asking for.
Surely not.
It will be an attack on working people in the state of Alabama, an attack on working people all across the country, and an attack on working people and their freedoms, their ability to organize, freely associate and strike and withhold their labor.
I mean, I think he says it pretty clearly there. It's an absolute affront to the right to collectively bargain. I hope that the NLRB is able to walk this back. I know there's procedural aspects to this, but even the fact that this sort of got out here in the first place, I find to be completely ridiculous.
I mean, that would be super disappointing because, I mean, the NLRB, I've heard, you know, different workers on different strikes being fairly, like, happy with certain NLRB decisions and, like, you know, seeing some improvement there. This would be extremely a discouraging signal. And also, like, take the Teamsters, of course, but BlackRock also said that they want an end to this strike, that it's, like, greed of management and that they should, which, I mean, I don't know if you can agree, like, believe BlackRock saying that, but it says something that they have to say it in the first place. But anyway, crazy.
Absolutely. So we'll be continuing to fill people in on that, but that's something that we need to start with. And don't worry, y'all, it's not all sour news. We're going to be talking a little bit about some of the disappointing aspects of the IRA in a second, but we have some positive news coming out of the UK. So for all people who say that we're too doom and gloom on this show, we got some good news coming.
Yeah. But without further ado, I think we're going to try to bring Ben Spielberg on now and, you know, talk about where our missing half loaf went. Ben, can you hear us? I'm not sure if Ben, shoot. I don't think Ben could quite hear that. So, let's see what, take a break here, and I'm going to try to get on the chat with
okay.
Ben.
And we'll be right back, everybody.
Yeah, let me put up a video here, and right there. Folks, there's David and Ben Spielberg. Ben, can you hear us? Ben? Testing. So, Ben. I'm not sure why Ben isn't able to hear us. So you can't. Sorry, I'm going to try to. I have to do this live, so you can't hear. Oh shoot, we're frozen for Ben.
Do you think maybe if we had like a simultaneous Zoom, he could hear us, because we're getting him loud and clear. Sorry, everyone, for the technical difficulty.
Yeah, he's gonna try leaving and coming back.
Let's do this UK segment then.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And you can double check with him as we're doing it to see if we got this, if he's getting sound from us. Well, I wanted to talk about this pretty damn exciting news as well. And Matt, not to make you do too much, but if you could have the slides handy too. I wanted to talk a little bit about this really exciting news that we're seeing out of the United Kingdom. We've talked a lot about what Mick Lynch and the RMT have been doing to really revive a working class politics in a country where so much of, working class politics has been completely decimated by the complete capitulation of the Labour Party to the interests of capital. Their cowardice in a moment like this, when one of the largest strike actions in living memory, Keir Starmer is out here saying that we can't be supporting Labour at all, right? That if you're a Labour member and you're going on the picket line and showing support for workers, you will actually be disciplined by the party. And I think it's a really important lesson for us in the United States, where like even if politically you might see that like the politics feel like they're a bit foreclosed on you, where you don't seem to have a lot of access or ability to be influencing politicians directly, maybe through the ballot box or through your relationship with the party, this is a way to fight and push back. So let's just play this video right now. If Ben's ready, I guess we can come back to this too on the other side.
We'll give it a shot here.
Let's give it a shot, and then we can come back.
Hey, Ben, can you hear us?
Hey, guys, I can now. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries, brother. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, just glad we got you. Thanks so much. So Ben Spielberg, he's making his second appearance on Left Reckoning, co-founder of 34 Justice. Characterized as a sort of political email list, Ben?
What, 34 Justice?
Right, yeah.
I'd say a political blog.
Political blog. Okay, cool. Yeah. We just want to talk a little bit about, I saw some tweets that Ben was firing off in the wake of, or as the Infrastructure Reduction Act was being passed. And before we get to that, let's play this clip from Bernie Sanders. A lot of people were getting upset with Bernie here. And I just want Ben to explain for folks what Bernie was doing and not doing.
To take a moment to say a few words about the so-called Inflation Reduction Act that we are debating this evening. And I say so-called, by the way, because according to the CBO and other economic organizations who have studied this bill, it will in fact have a minimal impact on inflation.
Okay, so Ben, with that, and we also played the clip of Bernie on Ali Velshi talking about, it's a modest step forward. Can you give us the sort of best spin on the half loaf, quote unquote? I'm hearing a lot go around what we actually got in this bill from your perspective. And let's start with the positive first.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and I would say, I think I wouldn't use the phrase half loaf, because I think if you just look at the spending or the revenue side of this bill, if we're looking at what Bernie originally proposed, you're talking about 7% to 12% of a loaf. And even if you're looking at what Joe Biden and Democratic Party leadership said was their agenda, again, their statement of what they theoretically wanted, we've got 12 to 21% of a loaf. So we've got a pretty small piece of bread here based on what, Democratic Party leaders said that they wanted. But there's really three components of this bill. There's taxes, provisions on taxes, there's provisions on healthcare, and then there's provisions on climate. Just to talk about what some might view positively, on the taxes side, which I actually think is the strongest kind of clear-cut positive case that you can make. There's investment in increased services for the IRS. And generally, studies find that when you increase funding for the IRS, particularly enforcement funding, which the bulk of this funding is, you make back the money four times over. So every $1 in increased IRS funding leads to $4 of increased government revenue, because it helps the IRS enforce the law on rich tax cheats primarily. So people who are breaking the law and evading their taxes, that's a problem that this bill will help to address to some degree. There's also a 15% minimum tax on corporations. Right now, legally, many corporations can avoid paying anything in federal taxes because there's so many deductions, credits, et cetera, that they can take. This bill for some of the largest corporations would provide a minimum tax rate of 15%. So Amazon, for example, couldn't pay 0% in a given year. They would have to pay at least 15% is the idea. And then there's a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks, which is when companies basically, instead of investing in anything productive, they just enrich their shareholders. There's now, with the Inflation Reduction Act, if it, you know, passes the House and is signed into law by Biden, there's also a tax there that is positive in terms of curbing some bad behavior from wealthy individuals. So I think that stuff is, you know, there's definitely some downsides to elements of it relative to what could have passed. But that stuff's generally pretty decent if you're somebody who's progressive. If you look at the healthcare part of the bill and the climate parts of the bill, I think this is where the 7-12% loaf of what, you know, Bernie originally proposed gets less clearly positive. But if you want to be positive about it, what you can say is for 3 years, you're extending subsidies in the Affordable Care Act that reduce premium costs for some people who buy healthcare on the insurance exchanges created under Obamacare. And you give the government the ability through Medicare to negotiate drug prices directly for a limited number of drugs in 2026. So those are kind of the two provisions on the healthcare side that people would say, you know, maybe a positive thing. And again, there are downsides to those things that we should talk about. Yes. And then on the climate side, there are generally on the kind of positive front, there's a slew of incentives in the tax code. So tax credits, primarily tax credits, that allow consumers to buy an electric car, make home improvements that are greener, that incentivize businesses. You know, it makes it cheaper for businesses to make investments in green technology. So that, you know, is something that you could say, okay, that's likely to help with the climate change issue to some degree. And then there are also some investments, although they're a relatively small portion of the climate investments. Most of them are tied up in the tax credits on direct investments in clean energy stuff. In the agriculture industry is probably the biggest part of those. But again, they're a pretty small portion of that climate funding. Most of it is for these tax credits. And then there are some bad pieces of the environmental piece. But if you were trying to only paint the positive picture, that's the stuff that you would highlight.
I want to get to the climate stuff more in depth in a second, but I was just wondering, Ben, if you wouldn't mind, because like something I've seen sort of floating around Twitter has been, you know, a bit of an actual opposition to some of this IRS funding, because I think most people sort of have an understanding that the IRS seems to come after working class and poor lower wage earners more than they do hyper rich people. You know, could you just maybe put some minds at ease about, you know, what this, you know, this extra funding, will end up meaning, not necessarily being something that's going to mean that the IRS is going to be coming down really hard on you?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So, I mean, generally speaking, it's easier to audit somebody who's not rich than somebody who is rich, which is very unfortunate. And the IRS oftentimes does tend to, you know, focus on things like, and this is, there are a lot of lawmakers, particularly Republican lawmakers, who really want to, for example, go after supposed fraud in programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit. The IRS has said with this increased funding, they aren't increasing audit rates on low and middle income people. It's really targeted towards enforcement of the rich, which generally speaking, the more resources the IRS has for enforcement, the more able they are to fight the tax lawyers and go after people who have much more complicated tax bills. So I do think this funding is a good thing. It is going to be targeted at rich individuals. I do think the IRS should not focus on low and middle income people in their tax audits. And this funding is geared towards going after the rich.
That's been the funniest, like Steven Crowder said, they're coming after you. It's like, well, if we all agree that they should be going after rich people, let's like write that into the statutory like clause, or like let's agree. But there's not actually agreement there, because the people that are really upset about this are upset that they're going to go after very wealthy people's taxes.
Yeah, but honestly, that's something I'd be willing to take, because, you know, generally also when you're talking about lower or middle income people, the issues with their taxes are usually mistakes or things because the tax code is super confusing, that something went awry when they were filing. But they're not generally people trying to cheat on their taxes. That's much more common that you'll find among the rich.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny you mentioned, you know, the ACA, because that's what this sort of felt like. I've seen a few like sort of podcasts, Best of the Left, a good show. They did a sort of positive take on this. And it was, this is a big climate deal, and it was like Joe Biden talking about the ACA. And you know, we've seen, I don't want to say, like, obviously the ACA has provisions that were extremely helpful in like giving material aid to people, but it also didn't get us to Medicare for all, like, for instance. And I remember, like, there's a whole lot, like, the way this conversation is happening, it's as if we're on the way there. And, you know, we've seen, we're old enough to have seen how that worked out with healthcare, that no, actually, we're still going on parallel tracks with some, like, members of the party leadership. Okay, so let's start talking about what's missing that we really should have included in this loaf, and then we can talk about why that's gone.
Got it. Well, and can we first just mention kind of what's bad about the climate provision? So, And kind of what I think has been a problem in the mainstream narrative about the climate provision. So a lot of what's been cited in a lot of the media about the climate provisions is this number of like 40% and this projected reduction of the climate provisions of 40% in greenhouse gases beneath the 2005 levels by 2030. You'll see that in many news reports and many tweets about this bill being the biggest climate bill ever. What they don't tell you with that number are two things. One is that the baseline projection, if there's no policy change, is generally around 25 to 30%, depending upon what your analysis is that you're looking at. So the models that they're using actually predict a reduction already. 40% is the inclusion of the Inflation Reduction Act number, but it's not that far above baseline. And in fact, there are some models, they have relatively wide confidence intervals because they're uncertain. And the confidence intervals overlap. And what that means, again, is, you know, one analysis, for example, from the Rhodium Group, there's a chance, based on their analysis, with no policy change, that you actually have a greater greenhouse gas emission reduction than with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. They think it's likely that the Inflation Reduction Act will reduce emissions further, but in their model, there's definitely scenarios in which the Inflation Reduction Act passes and we're not reducing climate change by as much as could have happened if nothing passed. So I think that that's important to note. The other piece that's really important to note about these models and about what's in the bill. So the bill includes a requirement that you lease land to oil and gas companies before you can do, for example, offshore wind. And that, in terms of its modeling impact, is actually discounted quite heavily in the models. So one of the models, again, that I read says that in the worst case scenario, they assume that that federal land for oil and gas is only going to lead to 25% consumption of whatever's produced, because they think, and they say that's the worst case. They say in the regular case, it's not likely to lead to any additional oil and gas consumption, because they think that the supply is going to be offset by reductions in the private sector or in other countries, which is just a crazy kind of baseline assumption and worst case assumption. So the models undercount the bad stuff, which is like there's giveaways to oil and gas. The models also don't include the effects of the side deal that Democratic Party leaders struck with Joe Manchin to build a fracked gas pipeline, which should have pretty big climate impacts. So it doesn't include those down. on side effects. And probably on the tax credits that I talked about, the effects that they assume are way too rosy, because for a lot of those tax credits, the people who are benefiting from them, they might have considered going green with whatever they were buying anyway. So it's not, and a lot of them are pretty small bore, like the electric vehicle tax credit. It's a $7,500 tax credit for a lot of cars. Like, that's not a huge percentage of the price. So like a lot of people, that's not going to really change whether they're likely to buy an electric car or not. So what I would say about the climate provisions in this bill, it's not clear to me that it's really going to make any sort of a climate impact. The models don't project a huge climate impact, and they way undercount the bad stuff and probably overcount the good stuff in the bill. So I'd be very skeptical of any claims you hear about the climate effects of the bill. And then on the healthcare side, you know, as you mentioned, Matt, this is a bill that really entrenches the power of private industry, because the ACA subsidies that it extends are a huge giveaway to the insurance companies. They really do reduce premiums for some people, but they do so by the government paying the insurance companies the cost of those premiums. And the plans themselves that those people have access to are really bad, with high copays and deductibles. And so if you get sick, even if you have one of those plans, you're gonna end up paying a ton of money. So I don't think the healthcare and climate provisions are huge wins in this bill. And my personal view, again, is that progressives made a mistake in accepting this bill, let alone celebrating it. But sorry, I know we should get to your other question of what's not in the bill.
Well, could I just add one thing too? Because I highly suggest people go, and after the law on the show, read the work of Matt Huber, like particularly on like the tax provisions, because, you know, this is such a favorite, you know, tool of, you know, the Democratic Party, is to use tax credits as a way to try to spur, you know, social investment. And, you know, I know we're not in power right now, so sometimes it can feel a little funny to talk about what we should be doing, but it is what we should be doing. You know, we should be investing in green technologies that go to the public, not to, you know, into the hands of private interests. And, you know, the way that a lot of these tax credits end up working is that a company continues doing their same kind of stuff, and they buy offsets from another company that might have not even really been polluting in the first place. So it's a little bit of like moving things around in the ledger, too, apart from the fact that it's, one, it's just not bold enough to change people's action. And then the way that some people read it is like, oh, we've invested billions of dollars into green energy, when it's just like, well, Walmart's paying, you know, some other company to, you know, some money for their tax credits that offset their activities.
I think that's a great point.
You know, let's, unless you got something to say on that, Ben.
No, go for it.
Well, let's talk about, before we get into what's missing, I do think, you know, let's ready to talk about how this was passed. And just before, to set the table for that, you had this tweet here, which is the one that I wanted to bring you on when I saw, like, Democratic senators are more united in telling Bernie Sanders that he needs to let go of dental and hearing benefits for seniors than they were in telling Joe Manchin he needs to drop goodies for oil companies or accept cash payments for families. And you have a series of tweets here, Brian Schatz. Basically, all we have a deal to take the biggest climate action in U.S. history, which I'll just comment, like, then call it that. Like, not the Inflation Reduction Act. They call it the Civil Rights Act, like the Civil Rights Act, right? Like, it'd be easier to believe you if you weren't so shy about it. You know, Cory Booker, again, basically all these people saying, I'll vote no on amendments, even the ones I agree with, to protect this bill. So just talk about the passage of this bill a little bit, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mentioned before, if we're talking about what Bernie proposed, it's 7 to 12% of a loaf. If we're talking about what Democratic Party leaders said that they wanted, it's 12 to 21% of a loaf. And the reason that I said that is because, you know, I don't think anybody expected, realistically, Bernie Sanders to get the bill that he wanted passed, because Bernie Sanders is one senator and he didn't win the presidency. And we know we're operating with a Democratic Party that is not particularly progressive. So, you know, I think while I would love for Bernie Sanders' bill to pass, I understand that that's not super likely, because Bernie Sanders doesn't control everything in the Senate. But Joe Biden again said that his bill was the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better investment. Democratic Party leaders, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, they said that their preference was the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better bill, and that was Joe Biden's agenda. And that was a year ago. And during that time, progressives made this pledge that they were not going to vote for the bill, the bipartisan infrastructure deal that Joe Manchin really wanted, unless they also got Joe Biden's bill, the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better agenda. Now, I already had some problems with what the $3.5 trillion had in it and didn't have in it, but it seemed like, you know, progressives were saying, we're going to hold strong. We're going to get the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better deal because it's not even our agenda. It's the Democratic Party's agenda. And it's going to be coupled with this infrastructure deal. What happened, as I know you guys know and have talked about in the past, is that Democratic Party leaders said we need to pass the infrastructure bill now with just kind of a, you know, verbal commitment from the more conservative Democrats that they're going to pass Build Back Better. Progressives decided to go along with that. And then what happened, very predictably, Build Back Better was sidelined after the infrastructure bill passed and Joe Manchin and the other conservative Democrats had what they wanted. I think that that was extremely predictable. What I said at the time, and again, this was back in 2021, is this doesn't mean that nothing's going to pass. The Democratic Party wants to pass something and they want to celebrate what I call a win in front of the midterms in 2022. So something is likely going to pass, but it's going to be the bill that Joe Biden, that Nancy Pelosi, that Chuck Schumer, the bill that they actually wanted, even though that they were selling that they wanted this $3.5 trillion bill, because Joe Manchin provided a very convenient way for them to say, look, we want this other bill. Unfortunately, because Joe Manchin now is not going to support it, we've got to pare stuff back. They're going to work and they're going to figure out something pretty close to what they actually want, which is what Joe Manchin wants, which is something substantially smaller that is a corporate giveaway. And they're going to pass that and they're going to tell progressives, you just need to accept it or you're not going to get anything. And that's exactly what happened, right? I mean, that is the Inflation Reduction Act. It is Joe Manchin, Chuck Schumer coming forward. Again, it was billed as a surprise. Manchin all of a sudden supports something. But I think if we look a year ago, we could say this is not a surprise at all. We knew they were going to come with something and they were going to tell progressives, this is all you're getting. Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have veto power. Progressives, you just need to go along with it if you want anything to help people. And that is what we got.
And I mean, I just think like the collection of tweets you have, you know, Cory Booker coming out, who else? Senator Alex Padilla. Like you never saw this when it was when there was threatening the with like when Biden or when Manchin was threatening the combination of the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better. You never saw them saying, "Hey guys, we all got to all keep this together." It's and that's like why people suspect like there's more than just Manchin and Sinema, and this is actually a leadership of the House and Senate problem.
Yes, and I think, you know, the key point there to me is because there were people who complained about Manchin, right? Like there were mainstream Democratic Party actors who complained about Manchin. Even the White House put out something saying, you know, Manchin's reneging on his commitments. But there's a difference between using your actual power and just using rhetoric to complain, because it's actually helpful for you what Joe Manchin is doing. So like when it comes to Bernie Sanders, right, he's going to put forward these amendments. All the senators are united in voting against the amendments because they're just saying to Bernie, look, you're going to vote for the final bill without the amendments. That's what you're going to do. They did not do that for Manchin and Sinema. They said, oh, this is terrible. Manchin and Sinema opposed the bill. We can't pass anything. They didn't go to Manchin and Sinema and say, no, you're going to support the bill, because we're not going to give you the infrastructure deal unless you support the bill. Or you're going to support the bill because you're not going to get funding from the DSCC if you don't support the bill. They didn't try any of that, right? So I think the big difference, it's not in the rhetoric so much, because they do say, oh, man, we really wanted to do this. It was Manchin and Sinema holding it up. It's that there are clear levers of power that Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi have that they do not use on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but they do use on progressives. They say, you're not getting anything unless you vote for it. So you better vote for it.
How afraid should progressives be of that threat? I mean, I guess we all agree here, and thanks for vindicating David and I's nomination of Jayapal as the Bumpster of the Year last year for splitting those bills up. But, you know, should I guess what you're thinking of, we got to be able to say no and deal with what they throw at us.
Yes. Well, and it's a really tough, I mean, I think this is a legitimate debate for progressives to have, and it's an important one to have, because it is really tough when you see something on the table that is for millions of people going to make a difference, not a huge, super meaningful difference. And it is going to entrench something, a system that is horrible for millions more people in the long run. But in the near term, people are hurting. You want to get them as much help as you can. And that is clearly like Bernie Sanders' calculus, right? The reason that he votes for this bill is because his view is I can get some premium help for people who are relying on Obamacare. I can get some prescription drug costs lowered in 2026. I can get some clean energy provisions, and I can get some taxes on the rich. That's better than nothing. And he's right, right? Like if I look today versus tomorrow, or today versus the day the Inflation Reduction Act passes, we are in an objectively short-term better state the day that it passes than we are today. But I think the fallacy of that reasoning, and the reason I really push progressives on this, is if everybody knows that's our perspective, that we will always take something as long as it helps somebody, even if it's really terrible and entrenches a system in the long run that makes the real change that we need much harder, we will always only get something and we will never change the system because everybody knows we're a pushover. Bernie Sanders can say until he's blue in the face, here are the amendments that I want in the bill. But nobody's going to listen to him because they already know he's going to vote for the bill in the end. So why do they need to listen to him? They don't. Unless they're aligned with him, which they're not going to. And so I think if you want to exercise your power, you really do need to be able to say, these things are non-negotiable. I will not vote for a bill that does not include these things. And if you do not do that, then you basically are removing all of your power for yourself. So I think part of the problem progressives have to deal with is something everybody acknowledges. We're up against huge institutional obstacles. But part of the problem, too, is like you guys said with your award for Jayapal, is progressives are using bad strategy over and over again because they're thinking always in terms of the short term getting something rather than the long term. How do I build a strategy so that I can effectively wield power and get more of what I want?
Yeah. And I think that's important because, you know, I think, look, like you said, like I can grant certain realities about this being something being better than nothing, or it being better that, you know, Biden was in office to do this instead of, you know, whatever Trump. But like at a certain point, you need to move beyond that because, you know, it's not getting us to any sort of place we're supposed to be. I mean, is there anything in your wish list that we should be going for? I mean, I hear Biden should be calling a climate emergency. We should be nationalizing fossil fuel industries. We could just buy those with the Federal Reserve Bank. What comes to your mind?
Well, so, you know, the thing that I was thinking a year ago that progressives should have said, and this was even before they kind of reneged on their tethering of the infrastructure bill and Build Back Better, was a robust expansion of public insurance. Because we're in the middle of a pandemic. To me, healthcare is a salient issue, and it's a hugely important issue for millions of people. So my thinking was if progressives could have gotten something that Joe Biden says he supports, Chuck Schumer says he supports, Nancy Pelosi says she supports, and hundreds of Democrats in the House and the Senate combined say they support, which is expanding the Medicare eligibility age to at least 60, or having a robust public option. To me, I would have said, okay, as a progressive, you can vote for that bill because that meaningfully advances us to universal health care. It doesn't give you everything you want, but you actually are making huge inroads on the system of healthcare in the United States and moving it towards a public system. That to me would have been a big non-negotiable. Progressives never did that, unfortunately. I think that was a bummer. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is crazy that nobody did for this bill, and it'll be interesting to see if we get it later, but the child tax credit improvements is something that like more kind of, I would say, mainstream Democratic organizations touted heavily as bringing a dramatic reduction in poverty. These are cash payments to families with children. And, you know, I talked to some people who work kind of more in Democratic policy circles still, because I used to, but I have friends who still work in that, around the time of the negotiations last year. And I said, okay, fine. Like, I know your philosophy is often you'll take something, but you guys have to have some sort of a bright line. So what would need to be removed from the bill for you to say, no, we're not going to vote for it? And I had actually one person told me, look, if the child tax credit comes out, probably I would say we shouldn't support it. But now that we're here a year later, the message is, okay, that's out and that sucks, but we'll work to get that later and we should still support the bill. And my view again is, no, you have no negotiating power, right? Yeah. Like if you're going to not take a firm stand, this has to be in the bill or I won't vote against it. then you're going to lose time and time again, because when circumstances change and something rolls around and you're handed, you know, a 12th of a loaf, you're just going, everybody knows you're going to accept it. So you have to break that dynamic.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the pantomime that we saw at the end of the bill where, you know, what's Manchin going to get? Okay, we're seeing, like, you know, the Kremlinology, like, it looks like Manchin might be a yes if he gets certain goodies. And now we have to throw it to Sinema. That, all that sort of, that shows who had the actual power there in a way. And it wasn't like, oh, we got to make sure, you know, Bernie Sanders is okay with this, because we knew that if Bernie's going to do that, every senator was going to be like, I agree with everything Bernie's ever said in his life, but we got to, you know, keep this moving along here.
Exactly. And I mean, again, part of that is there's a real structural thing there where, you know, Manchin and Sinema are Republican-esque, and either you get some Republicans or you get Manchin and Sinema, and that's the direction theoretically you have to move. But the thing that is also true is part of the reason Sanders is irrelevant is because of our own choices as progressives, where we signal we'll take it. In the end, we'll take whatever you give us. So I think we got to break that dynamic. We are up against real institutional obstacles. There's a lot of work to be done to build more progressive power in Congress. But the progressives who are already in Congress, they do have more power than they act like they have a lot of the time. And it's because they just sacrifice it away. And you can understand why, but they really need to change something if they want to start getting some wins.
Can I ask you, like, I know this is a broad question, but, like, you know, one of the things that's sort of tough about this when we're talking about, quote unquote, like, progressives in Congress, it's like, you know, that's a very loose set of, like, individuals. So I think agree on some things and maybe really disagree on others. I mean, could you give anyone, like, a slight picture as to, like, how much even, like, real coordination that there is between all of these different figures? You know, because I think that's like an institution that I think is tremendously lacking. And I don't know if it could be built with the current cohort, but.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think in the Senate, it's really Bruni stands alone most of the time. Yeah. I mean, you have a couple senators who are better than some of the others, but Bruni's really the only one who's hardcore trying to fight for people. In the House, you have a broader contingent of people. So, you know, I think you think about the squad, you think about some of the newer people who are elected into that. So, like, when you think about Cori Bush, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, AOC, Jamal Bowman, even, you have, and I would say Ro Khanna, for example, too. Like, these are actual real progressive people. Pramila Jayapal, the people who endorsed Bernie in 2020. This is a contingent that if they stuck together on things, they would have some real power. But I think, like you said, David, there's not always an indication that they are as coordinated as they could or should be. And I do think that that is something to pay attention to, because the Congressional Progressive Caucus contains a lot of non-progressives. There's a much smaller wing of the Congressional Progressive Caucus that actually creates or includes people who have legitimately good views on a lot of stuff, but they don't seem to stand together and wield their power as a group as much as they need to.
Yeah, and I mean, just from a programming note, I mean, I think that's the thing that needs to be emphasized among the left right now. I know that, like, people are pretty sensitive to the there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats, folks. But I think that we need to, like, move beyond that and just say, like, we need to start pushing that the Democrats that do have our ear in a way that, you know, shows a backbone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, again, I think it's good to be really critical of our greatest friends. You know, again, I think I said this in one of my tweets, like, I love Bernie. I think he's great. I appreciate that he's really the one person in the Senate who actually fights for people. But I still think he had the wrong strategy here, because everybody knew that he was going to vote for this bill in the end. So I think we've got to be willing to be hard on our friends. We've got to be able to recognize that there are differences in degree between different Democrats, between certain Democrats and certain Republicans, but we've got to push the people who are aligned with us in a lot of these policies to actually use an effective strategy.
Absolutely. Ben Spielberg is at Ben Spielberg on Twitter. Folks, give him a follow. Thanks so much for making time for us tonight, Ben.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's great, and apologies for the technical issues.
All good. I'm just relieved we were able to get you. So give Ben a follow. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. There's certain
nights where certain things happen and certain people just take over, and Ben was just on a roll.
No, he's it's good to get that kind of, you know, inside perspective. Not that he's, you know, an insider in that way anymore. Well, like somebody who knows how those structures work.
Right. He's concerned with details, like, you know, actually, like, as opposed to just kind of, you know, I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to tear others down to build Ben up, but Ben's really great at analyzing this stuff in a way that I think is productive. Yeah, well, David, speaking of analyzing things in a way that's productive, are we going to go across the pond now?
Yeah, let's go take a quick visit to our friends in the United Kingdom. I started teasing this a little bit earlier, but, you know, what's been happening there has been absolutely historic, wherein the RMT has been engaging in these pretty serious, well-organized and very well-supported industrial actions against, you know, the train companies, which have been squeezing and lowering the cost of living effectively as inflation goes up in that country, like it is going up globally. And they've been pushing back and fighting back, despite the fact that the Labour Party has made it very clear that they don't care about workers, that they'll turn their backs on workers at every chance given.
I mean, insanely clear, almost farcically, like a Monty Python sketch.
I'm waiting for Keir Starmer to give a speech along those lines at this point. I mean, the only thing he said, you know, notable about what their economic policy is that it will be distinctively British, which is a very dark warning for what the future would be looking like under a potential Labour government. But that being said, so what's happening there has been absolutely historic, and we've been talking about a lot on this program, particularly, I think, for the lessons we can gain here in the United States. You know, we're not in the same place as they are in the UK when it comes to density and militancy in their unions. But I always make the point that, like, I remember especially like 2018 when I was first coming on TMPS and stuff, people would be like, well, David's talking about politics outside of like who we're voting for. And me trying to oftentimes just like, you know, there's a whole world of ways that you can influence and fight and win for working people that aren't just waiting for, you know, a good chance to do it at an election. And I think what we've seen from the RMT and McLynch has been tremendously inspiring. What we've seen from Unite the Union, you know, saying that we're not going to fund the Labour Party anymore if they're going to turn their backs on workers, has been incredibly inspiring. And there is a new development in the UK with a new organization that has just started called Enough is Enough. And let me just let these folks speak for themselves. This is a couple minutes. It starts with Mick Lynch, but this is a new group that is trying to actually channel and activate the working class movement in that country instead of waiting for the Labour Party to be ruled by not be ruled by ghouls.
People are fed up with the way they're treated at work. We need to turn that mood into real organisation on behalf of the working class.
Enough is enough.
There's always another crisis, and it's always workers who pay the price. We've suffered the biggest pay squeeze in history, and workers become all about working harder and faster for less. And now they want you to pay for it all again. Well, it's time somebody else paid the price.
Things can't go on like this.
Record profits for big business, record number of billionaires, record wealth for the top 10%. But life is getting harder for everyone else.
You always make the sacrifices, yet they always reap the rewards. None of this is inevitable.
It's a political choice, your need or their greed.
So it's time everyone in this country who's got a rotten landlord, who's got a low wage, who's got in-work benefits, who's going to a food bank, who can't get a doctor's appointment, who can't get housing. It's about time we all stood up together and said, enough is enough.
This cost of living crisis affects us all.
This is not just about rail workers or cleaners.
Posties, engineers or call centre workers.
Or nurses or teachers or firefighters.
It's about you and every workplace and every community across this country.
It's time for a campaign that draws the line.
It's time to say enough is enough.
Fair pay, affordable bills, enough to eat and a decent place to live. These things are not luxuries. They're your rights.
This is a campaign to bring people together.
For a real pay rise, to slash energy bills, to end food poverty and for decent homes for all. And to finally tax the rich and big business.
If you agree, share this video, spread the word.
And sign up today at wesayenough.co.uk.
We can't be divided. We need everybody campaigning for a better deal.
We will be organising rallies. We will be forming community groups. And we will be on picket lines.
We're going to be standing up for ourselves.
We're going to fight.
We're not all in this together. We never have been. The people that are in this this together, and working class people have been mugged for far too long.
It's time to say enough is enough.
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 It's time to channel anger into action.
I mean, one, that's like probably one of the better political ads I've seen in a long time. And two, like, this is actually directing people to doing something that can actually influence and improve their lives. You know, for people who, again, are UK listeners, I'm sure you're already on it. But that's definitely an organization that you should be joining. You know, it has a lot of trade unions in it, also has social organizations, even some members of the Labour Party, like Zara Zoltana and Ian Byrne, which is like, that's exactly the kind of activity that you should be doing if you are an elected Labour official. Because remember, there are people who are still by Corbyn who have been very marginalized and pushed out, but they're still there. Yeah. And I find this to be a very inspiring move. Ronan Burtonshaw, our friend at Tribune, is a founding member of it as well. So kudos to them.
Oh, nice. Somewhere
like 200,000 people have signed up already, which, you know, just a reminder for our American friends, that's a lot of people in the United Kingdom, which is not as large as the United States. I mean, that's a really successful launch of this organization. And I find the way that it's like, it's tying all of these different groups together. I forget his name, but one of the other RMT members said something along the lines in that video. You know, it's not about us, like, all coming together. There are sides here. There are rich people and us. And I love that kind of dynamic where it's not like, let's all get together for kumbaya. It's like, no, we're getting together and we're fighting back against the people who profit and enjoy our suffering.
I was just going to say, that's the best line of the whole thing, when it's like, we're not all in this together, actually. Who is in it together is working people. And like, if you're socialist, you got to feel seen by that. Because like, that we're all in this together shit has never fucking worked for anything good. Like, honestly, like, it's paralysis politically. Yeah, that was awesome. Who is that? The guy who
is Eddie Dempsey. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, Eddie's coming up there too. Mick getting a lot of the shine, but hey, and there's the Beatles, and then like, hey, maybe we'll get like the Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd, and just these. Yeah, exactly. But instead they're all labor leaders from the UK.
Fuck yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly what we need. Yeah, so just a little bit of a bright spot, and like, look, I don't want to gush early because it's a new organization. We'll see what comes from it, but this is the kind of thing that I think is important for us to remember in the States. It's like, you know, victories and inspiration come up and down. And get a little personal for a second. Like, when I was working on that video that came out for patrons on what was left populism, I'll admit I got a little misty-eyed watching some of the old Bernie Sanders ads and speeches and the Corbyn stuff, which hopefully I'll be able to get that out to y'all soon. You know, and I didn't expect it to hit me as hard, but I just remember like being there in 2018 and like really feeling like some really better stuff was around the corner. And sometimes you forget like how inspired and excited we were just a few years back. And the reason I bring that up is that if you think about what's been happening in the United Kingdom, it's been, you know, we're brothers on this, like just like absolute horrific quote unquote left parties, an ascendant right wing. And pretty unfortunate defeats for our kind of left progressive socialist movements in those countries, right? And what's happened here is that people have been pushed to their limits, so they're going on strike, and they're building out of that. And I bring that up just to say that, like, you know, a lot of times people look to us and they ask, you know, about hope, and I do suggest you read Mike Davis' stuff on hope, where he says it's not a very serious category. But I do understand that we need that fuel to like keep going. And remember that like we can get momentum, and we can create organizations, and we can start pushing back at any time. Like, this is not a historically strong time in the United Kingdom for like the left wing or like the labor movement, right? They're being squeezed, but it's through fighting back against those conditions where you're seeing inspiring stuff like this happen. And I think that's the kind of mentality that you have to have. You know, it's not just waiting for somebody to come from up high to deliver for us. It's something that we need to find a way to organize this collective frustration and despair into like positive action, so we can start directing our attention and our abilities to defeating our enemies who are making our lives worse. So it's just a good reminder to folks that like things can get really dark and feel hopeless. But there's no reason to sit down because things can move really positively in the other direction very quickly.
Yeah, I think I like that about the hope as a category. I think there are alternatives on offer, and like one of it is just being able to recognize like work that is productive and toward the right object. And, you know, whether or not that is you're going to see that come to fruition in some sort of socialist revolution or not isn't really the metric. It's this is the right direction, right? Like compared to like a lot of like, you know, I mean, everyone knows the fucking Forward Party is a joke, right? Like there's a lot of different like bullshit on offer. But like this sort of thing, I mean, it's a lot easier for me to endorse at the outset because it's just so clearly identifying the actual issue.
I totally agree. Well, yo, I think we're going to run over the post game. We've got a couple quick things to get to. One, if you want to leave us a voicemail on the post game, the phone number is 1-940-289-7234, 940-289-7234. We always love hearing from y'all. If you want to leave us a message and have it listened to and us respond to it on air, you got to sign up and become a patron at patreon.com/leftreckoning. You also get access to the Discord, the bonus episode, and all of the post games going all the way back. I mean, 79 now. We've had some pretty fun stuff happen behind that paywall that I think a lot of people are missing out on.
Yeah, I think I know that as several of the most recent ones, I think.
That's very true, too. But a couple really quick things. I'm really excited to announce a collaboration that we're doing with our friends at This Is Revolution podcast. Right. We're going to be calling it, what was the name? Revolutionary Reckoning?
Yep, Revolutionary Reckoning.
Revolutionary Reckoning. So if y'all aren't already familiar, our good friends at This Is Revolution do an amazing show. And we're going to be joining them. They'll be joining us. We're going to be joining each other in a new offering on Thursdays, I believe at 8 Eastern, 7 Central, where we're going to basically be doing a kind of news breakdown for the week. So each of us will bring some stories, be looking at stuff in the chat. So be sure to join up and look out for that. It'll be on our channel and on their channel. Also, if people have any ideas for like logos or music or something like that, as always, feel free to reach out because I think we could come up with something fun to sort of merge the two compatible with different vibes that we have for that program, from those two programs.
Yeah, it could be a little hangout pod, which, you know,
it's good. Matt and I have always wanted to do. And lastly, before we go, Matt, I mean, let's do you mind pulling up the store so we can show people some of this merch?
Yes, and I just realized what one thing we do need to do is add a store link to the leftreckoning.com. Oh, nope, I see it.
I said shop earlier. It's store.
Gotcha, okay.
Leftreckoning.com/store. Apologies.
Here is, you know, got our so model.
Look at this beautiful model over here. We got three offerings. We got this fun shirt, the LR on the road shirt. We got our trucker hat. Which is a snapback. Some people were worried about head sizes. I have a big ass head too. I understand. But it will fit your head. I promise you.
Yeah. And, I'm all snapback too. So I can't, fitted used to be cool, but, and I have some fitted hats, like baseball hats, but I prefer a snapback.
And, we also have the tank top, which Matt will take some nice pictures of him flexing his muscles in over the weekend, I'm sure.
Yeah, so definitely. And it comes in all these different colors. Look at that. I think I want one in every single one of these colors.
They're actually pretty cool. And they all turned out great. So check that out. We'd love to start seeing some LR merch out there on the streets. And, you know, when you get them, send us, tag us and we'll retweet them and all that good stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
It's nice,
we get a free
it's nice to get those out in the public. And also for me not to be the only one wearing them, because I feel a little embarrassed sometimes wearing my own hat out around town because people are like, what was that? It's like,
I feel the same way.
I always say it's my friend's podcast.
I got an alter ego.
You're my friend.
It's not my podcast. It's ours. It's like Russell Wilson wearing his own jersey.
But I'm sorry. I'm not even trying to really sell this. This has actually fast become like one of my favorite hats. It's a very comfortable, nice, cool hat for the summer here in Texas. So
it's cool. A great hat. And I just realized that if we did want to make a North Dakota version, all we'd have to do is very slightly change the shape of the patch, and then because it looks like the shape of North Dakota. But
we can do it soon. But anyways, y'all, I'll just pop that phone number one more time at the bottom, but we'll be jumping over into the post game. I guess give us to like 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, and we'll be seeing y'all over there in just a few minutes.
Oh, yeah, and we also have to say no international business.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, friends. We will get it functional, but I can't figure out the shipping yet for Canada and Australia, UK, but soon I'll let y'all know when we can ship those internationally.
Once David's through Capital Volume 3, he'll be skilled enough.
I'll be ready. I'm telling you, Bubba, like going through like the tax code shit is scary enough in the United States. I'm not ready to start dealing with VAT or whatever the fuck they have over there. But soon, I promise. Anyways, folks, we'll be over the post game in just a little bit, and see y'all soon.
Peace.